the Underdog Podcast from SB Nation and Underdog Dynasty.
Welcome to another episode of the Conference USA Underdog Podcast here on UnderdogDynasty.com, SB Nation's home for G5 football. Talking about some good stuff and some kind of touchy stuff in within the conference today, but we're going to cover it all for you as we usually do. Joe Londrigan here, Western Kentucky representative. I don't know what you even call me anymore. I don't write as much as I should. Talking all things Conference USA here with my good buddy Eric Henry. How you do today, bud?
I am doing all right. Cannot complain, brother. How you doing, man?
Oh, it's all good. Just keeping an eye on Twitter and writing things about the sports ball, you know, as we all do, and try to not get too bummed out because it's been raining for like 4 days straight in Oregon now.
The old sports ball is there to keep you company. I mean, hey, you got Damian Lillard, and that should be enough to brighten your hopes at least for a little bit up there in Portland.
We do, yeah. The Blazers have been fun to watch this year, even though they've been weird in spurts. I don't know. I feel like that's a topic for an NBA show, but at the same time, that's really what I've found is like the center of sports culture here. It's not even the Ducks, it's the Blazers, and then everyone else is just kind of trickling in with everything else, as weird as that is.
Well, I mean, yeah, that kind of makes sense. I mean, I know the Blazers have been there since like the early 70s. I know they're pretty a pretty hardcore basketball town.
For sure, but like at the same time, you have like the Ducks and the Beavers and that whole football rivalry, and then I guess there's some Pac-12 representation in there too. There's a lot of UW people, a lot of Wazoo people, but I don't know. I guess just it's a little bit of a culture shock coming from like a little town in the Midwest where like college sports is king. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. I'm with you there.
Well, let's dive into those college sports like we usually do. And to start off the show, let's talk about a little personnel change down in Denton that we hit on a little bit last week with Graham Harrell going to the University of Southern California to be their offensive coordinator. It now looks like Seth Luttrell has found their replacement there. Two replacements, as a matter of fact. Bodie Reeder, the former Eastern Washington offensive coordinator, will be one co-offensive coordinator for the Mean Green, while their pass game coordinator, Tommy Mainford, will be the other co-offensive coordinator. We, of course, know the kind of success that North Texas has had passing the ball the last couple of seasons. And for those of you that maybe don't follow Big Sky Conference football that closely, Eastern Washington threw for 272 yards per game in 2018, 582 yards per game total, and scored 43 points per game. So while I'm typically not a fan of the two co-offensive coordinator approach, I think they clearly have two guys here who know what they're doing in terms of moving the ball down the field.
It's funny you say that, Joe, because like you, I am not a fan of the co-offensive coordinator deal. We've seen that kind of, you know, work with varying degrees of success. You kind of saw it with Bowling Green, for example, the past few seasons under Mike Jenks. They did the co-offensive coordinator thing. And while the passing game, you know, kind of flourished, the team overall on the field didn't do too well. And there's, you know, a myriad of examples. You can go around the country and see that. But in this case with North Texas, I think you have the right nucleus. You know, you have Seth Luttrell who's in place. You bring in an assistant who's the passing game coordinator to kind of keep that continuity. And you bring someone in, like you said, who is coming from a background of being a passing team. And most importantly, you have Mason Fine. So, you know, I think Dakota Gregory wrote for us a couple weeks ago, kind of joked around that maybe you should make Mason Fine the co-offensive coordinator. And, you know, while he was kind of joking, I think you have to just kind of take into consideration the fact that you have a very accomplished passer back there. And as long as you have someone like Fine back there, you know, calling the plays and getting the ball out of his hands very quickly, the offense is in good hands overall.
Right. And I think it's been talked about a little bit that Seth Luttrell was going to call plays this year, or at least he's going to do that. He's thinking about it. He's going to call plays in spring practice, which I understand he hasn't done in a while.
Yeah, and personally, I don't know how you feel about it, Joe, but I'm a huge fan of, I don't think the head coach necessarily has to be the offensive coordinator if said head coach has an offensive background. However, I do think that the head coach should probably be the play caller, just because I think when you're kind of going down with the ship, you kind of have your hands on it, so to speak. So I would be all in favor of Seth Luttrell being the play caller.
Yeah, I agree with you in that. I'm typically a fan of when a head coach kind of takes the reins in that way of his team. And, you know, I think there's just – if they kind of just stick to what they've been doing, I think they'll be – okay. I think just in the past two seasons, really, they've been like that close to, you know, either winning a conference title or being in contention for one. It's just come down to like little things here and there. So I think, you know, I don't think whether Luttrell calls plays or not, I think if they just kind of stick to what they've been doing with the kind of personnel that they continually bring in on the offensive side of the ball, I don't think there's too much to worry about there.
Yeah, once again, I'm right there with you. I think this is just my thing as far as UNT goes. I just like to see them get that running game going. And they did have a pretty steady running game this year. But if you can have that running game going at a consistent clip to complement Mason Fine, you know, all things considered, you'll be in good shape.
Right. And I think that's part of the reason why Bode Reeder was an attractive hire here, because you look at Eastern Washington and they've traditionally been a pretty pass-heavy offense, but last year they really kind of balanced it out and made another pretty good run in the FCS playoffs, if I'm not mistaken. So I think that had to be a good thing to list on his resume, coming from, you know, a situation down in North Texas where they are trying to run the ball a little bit more, or they need to anyway, to try to balance things out. So I think we're in agreement here that they're going to be okay regardless.
Absolutely.
Cool. So next thing that I wanted to get into this week on the site, you wrote an article about the 10 toughest players to replace in Conference USA in 2019. I really agreed with all your picks here. Top three, I believe, were Devin Singletary, Brent Stockstill, and Jalen Ferguson. And, you know, the rest of that list, I feel like, was all good guys, pretty interchangeable in that aspect. But it just makes you realize there really are just a lot of names here that losing them is going to make a huge difference for their respective teams. And I was wondering if you want to kind of explain, you know, your approach in thinking about this and maybe some other honorable mention guys that you left off of here.
Sure, yeah. Before I do that, though, let's trickle back for a second talking about offensive play callers. Did you happen to catch Lane Kiffin's tweet, you know, talking about taking a very aggressive offensive strategy, so to speak? Did you happen to catch his tweet earlier this afternoon, Joe?
Oh, yeah. He said Jennifer Aniston, come to the FAU. Is that what you're talking about?
That's correct. One, Jennifer Aniston is celebrating her 50th birthday, and Lane, who is a single man, just politely tweeted out, hey, you know, come to the FAU. So I guess we'll take a second here, Joe. For the listeners at home, uh-huh. Joe is spoken for, but I'm not. So I only mention that as to say I'm all in favor of shooters shooting their shot when the shot is there. You miss, you know, 100% of the shots you don't take, as Wayne Gretzky / Michael Jordan said. That quote has been attributed to many people. So Joe, I'm all hey. I wouldn't complain if Jen Aniston decided to make an appearance at the Shula Bowl, the annual FAU-FIU game. That would be a great time for her to come to the FAU.
Oh, of course. Like, that would generate just some kind of crazy buzz if that actually worked. Because I feel like, you know, it was Lane Kiffin also that offered, like, a scholarship to, like, a baby, like, in the past couple weeks, right? Like, I don't know. He's a bold guy, and fortune historically has favored the bold, I guess. But yeah, I mean, I've been out of the romance game so long at this point, or at least the trying to woo women world, that I genuinely don't know what works anymore or what's okay and what's not. But I feel like in this case, that made me laugh. You know,
all jokes aside, Lane's is a very unique Twitter follow. I mean, if you see him, he kind of has his spurts where he goes away and comes back and whatnot. But Jake Ellman, who covers the team for the Palm Beach Post, you know, noted that when Lane's back on Twitter, all is well in Boca.
Oh, for sure. It's part of his mystique at this point. And it's really just kind of adds to, like, the G5 football sphere, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, the more he kind of goes about these weird little Twitter things, it makes the whole thing more exciting. Whether it's him talking about Saban, or whether it's, you know, stuff like this where he's just trying to like recruit Jennifer Aniston to come to a game. I think, like I mentioned, it just makes the whole thing more entertaining, and it's part of the FAU brand now. So I say just roll with it. Jumping back into the conversation about toughest players to replace in this league, obviously Singletary is up there. Ferguson had an absolutely phenomenal year rushing and getting through offensive lines. But I would love to know kind of how your thought process in putting this whole thing together.
Yeah, Joe. So really, I kind of just had one major philosophy, to be honest with you. It was, if a team has someone, if a team has someone who is kind of slated to replace player X, then I kind of, you know, devalued that in a sense, right? So, for example, if you look at Devin Singletary with FAU, mm-hmm. had Kareth White Jr. been returning, more than likely Brent Stockstill would have been my number one. But with them losing both players, granted they have B.J. Emmons, who's, you know, the big transfer, former Alabama player, went the JUCO route, has reunited with Kiffin, but he's still kind of an unproven commodity. So I kind of put more emphasis and more precedent on if the team didn't really have someone to replace said player. And also, if the team, to be honest, you know, didn't have a good year on the field last year and they're losing the one player who may have stood out, that helped kind of make some of those decisions for me. And it's funny you mentioned that, because the three players who really kind of got the most controversy were Devin Singletary and Jalen Ferguson. Believe it or not, when the article was tweeted out on the Underdog Dynasty Twitter, a lot of the feedback first off was from I want to give a shout out to Shane Marinelli, who Shane's a good guy. He's kind of a FAU troll / FAU sycophant. he was like, we'll be fine without Motor. We'll still win 9 games. The bigger issue will be if Chris Robson can improve. And sure, you know, you want to pay close attention to whether Chris Robson can develop as a quarterback, but I think he was greatly undervaluing the impact of Devin Singletary as a running back. So that one kind of stirred up some controversy. And the other one, weirdly enough, was Jalen Ferguson, who got some feedback from a couple Louisiana Tech fans. I want to say it was the La Tech Report on Twitter, I believe. Sorry if I didn't identify them properly, but they mentioned a kid, Willie Baker, Joe, who was a kind of a 3/4-star player who's behind Ferguson. They didn't see the field at the same time, but Ferguson, Baker would kind of spell Ferguson, and had a nice year as well. Had about 30-something tackles and I believe 5.5 sacks. So he had a solid year. Mm-hmm. But they were making the case that, Jalen, they're not saying that he was replaceable, but that essentially Baker would be able to come in and it'll be his time to shine. And I'm like, you know, guys, all Ferguson did was just set the FBS record for sacks in a single career. Right. So, I mean, I couldn't understand why those two kind of got the most pushback. But outside of that, you did mention if there are any other names I want to mention, and some of the ones that I did for Western Kentucky, Masai White is a guy you know very well. I thought he had a very nice season, a very nice career at Western Kentucky, and he's going to be tough to replace. Charlotte DB Ed Roll, he was kind of, you know, the linchpin as far as their coverage goes. Yes, they have Ben DeLuca, who's a very solid tackler back there in the secondary, but Ed Roll, he's a guy I got a chance to see firsthand in Charlotte. He's a very good cover corner. EJ Ajaya, that was one who North Texas fans were on the Twitter page as well, saying that I put Josiah Toafa in over EJ Ajaya. And once again, it wasn't that Ajaya isn't a talented player. It's that North Texas has a ton of talent coming back. And we know what the UTSA program has kind of been the past two seasons. And especially any hope of playmaking ability they had on defense really ran through Toafa. So that was my rationale for putting him there. And the other honorable mention guy I had was Xavier Yabosi. who, if you happen to see the bowl game, you know the type of talent he has at wideout. So that's going to be huge. But I'll very quickly run down the names, and I won't get, you know, too deep into all of them. Going from 10 to 1, I went Jack Fox at 10, who anyone who's followed Rice football or Conference USA football over the past three seasons know that this guy has far and away been the top punter in the conference. I think that's kind of not debatable. Mm-hmm. I did put Stone Wilson as my other honorable mention because FIU's going to have to replace Stone as well, but Fox has kind of set the bar as far as punters. At number 9, I had Jamel Garcia-Williams. He had a phenomenal season for UAB in that defense in his only year as a starter, 43 tackles, 9.5 sacks. O'Shane Zimenez is a guy who, if you follow this conference, you know that name. I think he's going to be one of the most sought-after pass rushers in the NFL in the draft. Coming in at number 7, I had Jordan Budwig at FIU. The running joke at FIU is that, you know, he's been there since half of the football facilities were built because Budwig, it was a sixth-year guy. He spent, you know, over half a decade at FIU and has honestly been the team's best offensive lineman since the day he stepped on campus. So Budwig is my guy at number 7. Although FIU does have some talented linemen coming back that will be able to try to fill those spots, guys like Shane Magoo and Mershon Miller and Dallas Connell, etc. Number 6 was Juwan Foggy. He's a really interesting guy to me, Joe, because you're talking about someone who, how often do you see someone go from wide receiver to linebacker, right? Not very often. And he was someone who's able to come in and make the switch from offense to defense and led Conference USA in interceptions from his linebacker spot with 6. So that was my guy at number 6. Finish off the last two here really quickly, Tyree Brady. Since he, you know, transferred him from University of Miami, you know the things he's been able to do at Marshall and Huntington. He's been one of Conference USA's premier pass-catching targets, so he's going to be tough to replace, although they do have Obi Obiolo, who's in tow, and a very big physical receiver as well, so we'll see how he fares. And then number 4 was Josiah Tuafo, like I said. He's a guy who set the program record for tackles as a redshirt freshman. Had an injury-plagued redshirt sophomore season, and then rebounded again this past year with 111 tackles, and will take his talents to the NFL. So those were the players on the rest of the list. And overall, I think it's just one of those things where you kind of take this conference for granted in a sense. I mean, maybe we don't because, you know, we're fans of it and we follow it and we cover it. But if you're someone who, you know, if you follow SEC football or Big Ten or whatever it may be, you don't necessarily realize there's a ton of talent in this conference. And I think, to be honest with you, all 10 of these guys should be making NFL rosters next year. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, and I guess after reading this, it kind of like, I guess, reminded me that there's a lot of like, maybe not a lot, but these 10 guys really are really prime examples of like NFL ready talent in this league. Like Fox for sure. I've been saying for a while that I think Singletary is going to make an impact for an NFL team. And then there are some really good pass rushers on this list with,
most definitely.
Yeah. With, Zimenez and Ferguson on there. I think it's, you know, I think offensive lines are just going to have a little bit easier time of it next year, it would seem.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, you know, you got Zimenez, you got Ferguson, you got Garcia Williams, and there's other guys on the list I could have put on there as well. So Conference USA, definitely ripe with talent. And while, you know, it's been interesting to see the guys who did get invites to the combine, how they'll perform. But overall, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing the Conference USA guys, you know, make the jump to the next level and represent Conference USA very well.
For sure. For sure. So looking forward to what these guys do next in their career. Speaking of someone who might have to start thinking about what's next in their career pretty soon, let's talk about Jay Hobson and Southern Miss football for a second. So for background, last week there was a little bit of a situation at Southern Miss. Jay Hobson interviewed former Baylor head coach Art Briles for an assistant position at the school. USM's administration then came out and said, no, Briles is not being hired. And apparently Hobson went over their heads and even bringing him in for said interview. However, Hobson then said in a public statement that he really wanted to hire Briles and that he disagreed with the administrator's decision to not allow him to get that job. So for more background, Hobson actually just got a contract extension before last season that keeps him there until 2022. And before we, you know, dive into this discussion, this whole thing is obviously part of a larger conversation that we really can't even scratch the surface of in this type of format. So with that being said, we'll just kind of talk about what happened there could and maybe should affect Southern Miss football, their head coach, and where they go from here. So if you're Southern Miss's, if you're USM's administration, you have to look at this and think about, A, here's a guy who really doesn't seem to see what the issue is in bringing someone like Briles onto his coaching staff, and B, isn't showing regard for authority within his place of work or your processes, the administrative processes that you put in place. So at that point, you have to wonder if he's even really worth it. I mean, he has a winning record, yes, but is dealing with the kind of, you know, PR situation and how that could conceivably affect your recruiting and, you know, win loss and record down the line and revenue after that. You know, is he worth it in terms of like just going 8-4 or 7-5 or whatever it is every year, for dealing with what bringing in someone like that or having a person who thinks the way Hobson clearly does on board, is that worth it? And, you know, I don't think it is, but, and, you know, we'll see what Southern Miss and their administration thinks as, you know, things kind of keep moving forward here.
Yeah, I mean, before I kind of give my thoughts on the entire situation, and, you know, we are all adults here, despite if you listen to prior podcasts, you might not think the two of us hosting this podcast are adults, but we all are. We all are here, you know, all jokes aside. And we're essentially talking about sexual assault, right? Uh-huh. So here's the question I want to ask you, because, you know, in your 9-to-5 life, you do deal with sports business and things of that nature. So I'm just going to ask you the question point blank, Joe. Do you think that it, from a pure PR, you know, marketing perspective, the best case scenario, right? Southern Miss goes 12-0 and wins Conference USA. Could that even have outweighed the negative publicity that they're dealing with now and would deal with in the future, in your opinion?
I would say no, especially not for like a small school like that. I guess just like, I'm trying to think of like an example of that, and I don't know that they're, I'm just struggling to kind of come up with an example off the top of my head of like someone who is that way, but has great success. And I would think, you know, no, because A, like, you know, going 12-0 with Southern Miss in the way that this league's set up right now, it's not going to happen. Like, really, the best they can hope for is like another 8-4 season in a bowl game. So it just, it doesn't, for a team that's like really just trying to like escape just being like a regional interest right now, it doesn't make sense at all for them to be going down that road. And it doesn't seem like they are from how they handled the Briles situation, but
yeah, you know, I think you made you make a lot of valid points there when you talk about the, as far as the risk versus reward here. This is not a team that's going to compete for a national championship and things of that nature. So, and like you said, there's somewhat of a regional program. No offense to Southern Miss fans who may or may not listen to this show. Now, like I said, we'll go ahead and deal with the elephant in the room here. It's like we're all adults. We're talking about Art Briles, who there were numerous sexual assaults committed by his players at Baylor. And I'm not going to be the person who's going to sit here and say Art Briles should never coach again. That's not my POV. But I'll give you an analogy, Joe. If I am the cashier and I take a high school job at Target, right, and I steal money out of the cash register and I get fired, I have more than enough right to go off and go to college and earn a degree and come back and, you know, work for Target corporate. But they probably aren't going to put me back on the register again, right? It's the same thing here. If Art wants to go, I think he's tailor-made for the pros, especially with the way that the NFL is going in 2019 in terms of the Baylor spread offense. And I think he has more than enough right to be gainfully employed in the NFL. However, in my opinion, he's forfeited his right to be a collegiate head coach or to be a collegiate coach in any facet. Due to the things that happened under his watch at Baylor. You know, I think, and let's just talk about the Baylor offense for a second, which is a very popular offense around college football, but you don't have to have him to run it. And when we're talking about the Baylor offense, for those who are not familiar, Art Briles is kind of the innovator of a very popular, what's termed the Baylor style spread offense. Mike Jinks, who I referenced earlier in this podcast, came from that tree and ran it. And it's run in a lot of places around the country. But you don't have to have Art Briles to run it. So even from just a pure X's and O's standpoint, I'm not sure why Jay Hobson, outside of they clearly had a relationship. If you saw Jay Hobson's statement afterwards, they clearly have a relationship and a friendship going back prior to this. So that could be the only reason why he chose to bring him in for an interview. And you made another great point talking about that he really, you know, kind of went over the administration's head just to kind of explore this for the bad PR and what, who knows. But to kind of close off my statement here, I mean, when the talk of bringing Briles in started, I read an article, and ironically enough, it was written, I believe it was Matt Baker of Tampa Bay Times, who wrote an article about Art Briles' son Kendall being brought in FSU. Mm-hmm. And there were complaints from female Florida State football fans who said, hey, I'm a survivor of sexual assault. What type of message does it send to me? And that kind of stuck with me. You know, I think the same thing applies here at Southern Miss. You know, what kind of message are you sending to your student body? I mean, look, you know, we're not going to sit here and pretend that athletics aren't a huge part of college and aren't given a priority. But in some form or fashion, you at least have to act like this is still an institution of higher learning. And I just think you're sending a bad message not only to your student body, but to the PR around the country. No one was talking about Southern Miss football on a national scale prior to this. Right. Now, when you think of Southern Miss football in the current space, you're thinking of Jay Hobson and Art Briles. So all in all, just the risk didn't outweigh the rewards don't outweigh the risks. And just in my personal opinion with, you know, Art Briles, he's more than fit to coach on the professional level, but he's forfeited his right to coach at college, in my opinion.
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of, like, you have to keep in mind that, you know, it's a college and there are things that go on there other than sports. And to the credit of Southern Miss fans, the overwhelming majority of them kind of seem to, you know, be in the boat of, like, we don't want this to be what our school gets publicity for. You know, that was, and at least in terms of, like, the social media reaction, that was what a lot of them kind of indicated. And they have a very good point. Like, and what just kind of blows me away is, like, what was Hobson's kind of response to this? Kind of came back as, like, yeah, it was just like, indignant of, like, you know, I won't get into it too much, but he was just indignant to the point where he was kind of publicly, like, I don't know, trying to, like, discredit, you know, the university president and the athletic department. And I just was like, dude, what are you doing? Like, you know, I get that he's like your buddy or whatever, but, like, he wasn't gonna make your team that much better immediately. B, you're hurting your own image by doing that. And it's like, and B, like, you're obviously hurting your relationship with your boss by doing this. Like, it's not worth it at all, at least from my perspective. And then the other thing was, the other thing was just, like, part of his statement was like, well, yeah, he did these things, but he's not going to be the head coach. And it's like, that's not the point at all. Like,
right.
Like, how are you this, like, I don't know. It was a very, like, the whole thing seemed really, like, tone deaf. And, you know, for the record, I agree with you in that Art Briles does not belong anywhere near college football, because so much of being a college coach in any sport is proving, like, you know how to lead young people and point them in the right direction, not just on being a complete athlete, but being a good and complete human being. And he completely failed at that aspect of being a head coach at Baylor. So, you know, that's all I'll really say about it.
No, yeah, I mean, I think as far as Jay Hopson's statement, once again, you kind of hit the nail on the head in that it was very tone deaf and just very aloof. Like, he didn't understand. It seemed as if he was almost confused at the outrage that was coming in his direction. And then furthermore, I understand, you know, hey, you want to get your homeboy a job, but then what happens when your homeboy has some baggage? We're going to start looking into your history. And I don't know if you saw this, Joe, where it was Nicole Auerbach of the Athletic who started talking, had an article that researched some players who Jay Hopson was bringing in who had baggage. So all the way around, it was just kind of a lose-lose situation. And I mean, for anyone, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, I would assume that you know about the situation at Baylor. If you don't, I just would punch in a quick Google search for Art Briles and Baylor. Once again, you know, we're talking about numerous sexual assaults in a program that had to shutter their entire staff nearly. So this isn't just a situation. It wasn't nearly as light as Jay Hopson made it out to be. And I would, you know, point anyone who is not familiar with it, I would point anyone to either Google, you know, Art Briles and Baylor, or Google Brenda Tracy, who does a ton of work in terms of college campuses and mm-hmm. trying to curb sexual assault. So that's, you know, where we'll leave it at that. But all in all, just not the best week for Southern Miss football, and it's not indicative. I'll end it on this. If you're and I know I'm actually close friends with some people who did go to Southern Miss and played other sports there. That's not what you want your school to be representative of and be in the news cycle for that. So.
Not at all. And you're right. We'll wrap it up at that, in that it was a really poor string of decisions by Hopson. And I guess at this point, we'll just see if, you know, what Southern Miss's administration thinks in terms of, is this even a relationship that's worth maintaining if, you know, this incident and some of other Hopson's behavior are what our program and our institution of higher learning are going to be known for moving forward. So I think that's a good place to end that conversation. Bringing it back to some other actual football related matters at FIU, there's going to be a change in staff there with Brent Guy stepping down, the defensive coordinator for the Panthers there. You know, Eric, as someone who spends as much time around that program as you do, where do you think the Panthers go from here on that side of the ball?
That is a really, really good question, Joe. This was something, a move that was not expected. For those of you who may just be finding this out and listening to this podcast, I'm assuming you will know by the time you hear it. But FIU defensive coordinator Brent Guy chose to step down today for personal family reasons. He said that, you know, he has some family obligations that he needs to take care of. There wasn't any you know, more of an elaboration than that. But Brent and head coach Butch Davis have a relationship going back 30 years to when Brent was a player at Oklahoma State and Butch Davis was an assistant under Jimmy Johnson. So, you know, it wasn't like, you know, maybe a disagreement, so to speak. It truly was some family issues that Coach Guy is going through. But if we want to bring it to on the field, and, you know, listen, as someone who covers his team and is at press conferences and practice and things of that nature, I've got to own up to things that I've written and said. Here's the fact of the matter. I haven't necessarily been the biggest proponent of Coach Guy's defense on the field, in the sense that there are a lot of talented players on this defense over the past two seasons, but they haven't gotten the most out of them. Now, with that being said, towards the end of the year, the defense started to pick up, especially in the bowl game. The run defense was phenomenal, and for my money, it was really their best performance of the year. We're talking about a run defense that gave up a 100-yard rusher to Arkansas Pine Bluff. So to bounce back and, you know, have the performance they did against Toledo was phenomenal. And the defense was trending upwards. However, Coach Guy's defense, this is the main stat that kind of sticks with me. The past 2 years, FIU's defense has been ranked in the bottom third in FBS football in tackles for loss. To me, that stands out because during his time as a defensive coordinator at Tulsa, his defenses were routinely in the top 15 in tackles for loss. And overall, just while the pass defense improved with guys like Stanley Thomas Oliver and Isaiah Brown, Dorian Hall, Richard and Rashard Dames, etc., the run defense just never really caught up, and that was kind of bewildering because there's a lot of talent across the defensive line. So to bring it back around to your question as far as where do they go from here, you just have to kind of check Coach Davis's pipeline, mm-hmm. and that's what I'll be kind of doing within the next few days. A question I got on Twitter is, could there be an in-house replacement? I think there's enough time between now and when the season starts that they can find somebody, but the closest thing to an in-house replacement would be secondary coach Jeff Cobb, who has spent the better part of the past 15 years as coaching various defensive positions, Idaho State, Northern Arizona, a myriad of places, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't look at him necessarily to be in line to be the next defensive coordinator. So I would just start checking Coach Davis's coaching tree, and you can probably put the tea leaves together. But all in all, you know, just from personal note, you know, we hope that Coach Guy, you know, whatever it is that he's dealing with his family, can, you know, wish him nothing but the best going forward.
For sure. But in your opinion, you don't think there's going to be an internal hire that inevitably gets this open position?
Yeah, if you look at Coach Davis's staff, mm-hmm. a lot of it was built around getting guys who have ties to the Miami area, so you could recruit that area well. Guys like Aubrey Hill is a wide receivers coach, Tim Harris Jr., who was a former high school coach in the area. Mm-hmm. If you look at the defensive staff, once again, you really had Brent Guy, who was the DC and linebackers coach. This is actually the third change. If you look at the offseason, it will be the third change to that defensive unit. Like I said, Coach Guy was the DC and linebackers coach. Kenny Holmes, a former Miami Hurricane, once again, another local guy, played for Coach Davis. He was defensive line coach. He's been replaced by another former Miami Hurricane and Butch Davis guy in Kennard Lang, who was a defensive assistant. And then you also have Bryn Renner, the former North Carolina quarterback, mm-hmm. will also join Jeff Cobb with their back there with the secondary. So there isn't really someone who you could say, like, there's a ton of experience and say, hey, that guy's going to be the DC. And for those of you listening, Coach Davis kind of made his bread and butter as a defensive coordinator with the Dallas Cowboys back in the 90s when the Cowboys won a championship. So, you know, it wouldn't shock me if Coach Davis has more of his imprint on the defense, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's no one internally that you can automatically point to outside of Jeff Cobb, who, once again, 14 years coaching various positions on defense, but no real experience as a DC.
That's interesting. I don't know. I guess I just didn't notice that pattern in Butch Davis's coaching tree before. But, you know, I wasn't necessarily worried from, like, a recruiting standpoint, because I feel like they've been really good about that in years past, or at least in the brief time that he's been at FIU. And then obviously it's paying dividends. So I think this is going to be, you know, an interesting coaching search then, I guess, because I feel like if he's looking for guys with ties to the Miami area, there's certainly plenty of those in the college football world right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of guys with ties to the Miami area who will be able to step in and recruit. And like you said, recruiting is not going to fall off. If it's one thing that Butch Davis can do, who I think is a very, quite frankly, I don't think he gets enough credit as a game day coach, but his players love him. His players swear by him. This goes back to UNC. This goes back to the University of Miami. And now at FIU, the players love Butch. You can see it in the post games. They're hugging him. And you know, he's the first one to tell me, I love you, man, and things like that. So you don't have to worry about that. And he's a heck of a recruiter, so that's one thing you don't have to worry about with Coach Davis. So I would just start checking the Butch Davis pipeline and kind of see where it can fit in. But in terms of recruiting Miami and South Florida, or recruiting in general, mm-hmm. He's got a great staff as far as recruiting goes, so they'll be fine there.
For sure. One kind of note to start wrapping the show up then on a happy string of thoughts, I guess. Western Kentucky Western Kentucky University Fellowship of Christian Athletes now has named an award after the late Mitchell Henry, called the Mitchell Henry Leadership Award. Two football players and two non-football players will get the award every year on the basis of character, work ethic, and leadership ability, and that comes with some scholarship money also. So really nice way to kind of honor a guy who played such a huge part in you know, some of these teams that Tyson Helton was actually a part of when he was a coordinator at WKU. And you know, obviously I think he was just a guy that, especially in the, you know, in the years leading, or in the year or so leading up to his passing, was really kind of a great symbol for Western's community. So I think that's a really interesting way to kind of honor him. And I think there was an article in the Bowling Green Daily News this morning, actually, that his parents are kind of really happy that the program's honoring him in this way. So that's something really cool to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, you know, it's great for Mitchell Henry and his family to kind of have that honor to kind of, you know, keep his memory alive. And I'm a huge fan of naming awards after you know, people in kind of that regard, because mm-hmm. a lot of times you don't really know the impact or you know, legacy that someone may leave. But when you have that award and you say, hey, I won the Mitchell Henry Award, and you kind of say, hey, you know, who was such and such, and you go back and know what they were about. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I'm also just kind of a fan in general of programs awarding athletes in this way with scholarship money for their work, you know, not just their performance on the field, but their work with service organizations or just being good people in general. That's really nice to see. And I think I was thinking about this as I was kind of reading it earlier this morning. It's been a wild 2 years to be just a fan of Western Kentucky sports in general. So I feel like, you know, between Tyson Helton coming back, this award, and then, you know, some of the other kind of good news that Hilltopper fans have gotten recently, like I think a volleyball player, Alyssa Kavanaugh, actually found like a bone marrow donor, so that's great. Things are starting to turn around for Hilltopper fans. I'm happy about it.
Absolutely, yeah. For Topper fans, yeah, they absolutely can use any type of good news they can get. Because like I said, it's been a strange, it's been a long, strange trip for the past 2 years of Western Kentucky athletics. So nice to have this, you know, kind of get things going.
For sure. With that, then we will go ahead and start wrapping the show up. Thank you all so much for listening once again. Something to keep in mind on a programming note, I believe we're going to switch platforms in the next couple of weeks. I don't know how that factors into our distribution, if at all, but we'll certainly keep you updated. One way to stay updated on future shows, of course, is to follow at Underdog Dynasty on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and check the site every day for more G5 football goodness as we get through the off season together. You can follow me on Twitter at @JOEHIO_. Eric is at @EricCHenry_. And we hope you'll join us for more shows in the future. Have a great week, everybody. We'll talk to you next week. Happy football watching.